Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy. In this phantasmagorical marketplace of ideas and blasphemies, we explore the dark places of the world, the darkest corners of the mind, searching for the monster lurking under the bed, the ghost moaning in the hallway, the alien tapping at your window. Be they creatures of flesh and blood and bone, figments of fertile imaginations, or something in between. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Happy Father's Day to all of you dads in the audience. Hope you got a really great tie from the kids, or maybe a couple of them, a barbecue apron, a chef hat, a new lawnmower, just what you always wanted. About our program tonight, if you've followed the UFO mystery to any extent over the years, and if you're listening to this program, chances are good that you have, to one extent or another, you've probably heard critics or skeptics say something to the effect that all you UFO crazies should get a life. Quit looking for meaning in your pitiful existence by searching for spacemen. Get a life. Tonight, we'll be joined by a man who most certainly got a life, one heck of a life, successful in many creative venues, with rich experiences and complicated relationships. He's searched for meaning in paintings and sculpture, in writing, and in really living to the fullest. You know him best as a groundbreaking investigator of the weird world of alien abductions. It's sort of a subgenre of the UFO universe that not so long ago was too goofy to be discussed even at flying saucer conventions and gatherings, but which now has sort of entered the ufology mainstream, if there is such a thing, and may in fact hold clues to the very heart of the larger mystery, the essential reason that they, whoever they are, come here to see and interact with us. His name is Bud Hopkins. He's written 4 books on the abduction mystery, books that, in my opinion, are essential for any UFO library. But there's a heck of a lot more to Bud Hopkins than UFOs. He is a world-class artist. He's a painter and sculptor who has mixed with and mingled with the giants of the art world, as well as writers and celebrities, the famous and the infamous. And then he sort of accidentally stumbled into this strange topic of UFOs and abductions, and life for Bud has never quite been the same. Yet he has managed to maintain a semblance of balance. He's written about the odd mix of these different topics in his latest book. It's called Art, Life, and UFOs, a Memoir. Coming up in hour two of this program, and staying with us, I hope, through the end of the program, or as late as he can hang on, the always fascinating Bud Hopkins. And even if you've heard Bud before, I think this interview, like the subjects covered in his latest book, will, I think, be a bit different from what has been covered in the past, and I am really looking forward to talking with him. I'll be opening up the phone lines in a couple of minutes to hear what else is on your minds tonight, but first, a look at a few select bits and pieces of news of the day. We go to the Gulf of Mexico. Another day, another estimate on how much oil is really pouring into the ocean. A report today from CNN says a BP estimate made after the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon noted that as much as 100,000 barrels per day could leak into the ocean if the blowout preventer and wellhead were removed, a higher worst-case scenario than previously reported. According to an internal BP document released Sunday by Representative Edward Markey of Massachusetts, BP believed that the worst-case scenario could be as high as 100,000 barrels. And if you want to do the math, that's 4.2 million gallons of oil per day. The figure is the highest yet to surface regarding this leaking oil well. As you'll recall, at the beginning, at the outset, BP had said about 1,000 barrels a day. And then the number was revised to maybe 5,000 barrels a day, and then 20,000, and then a lot higher. And BP was before Congress, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, a couple of days ago, and they told them the worst-case scenario was 60,000 barrels a day, 2.5 million gallons, that is, which is a lot lower, about almost 50% lower and what this new document states, this document that came out today. It was submitted back in May. It says that the 60,000 barrel estimate is their the best guess, but it stipulates that if this blowout preventer and wellhead are removed and we've incorrectly modeled the restrictions, the rate could be as high as 100,000 barrels a day. And this is what Congressman Markey says. The document raises very troubling questions about what BP knew and when they knew it. You don't say. We all saw the performance of BP's head honcho there before Congress a couple of days ago. It was disturbing in the extreme that this top guy in this troubled company, this gigantic multinational conglomerate, which, as I reported last time I was here, earns about $3 million an hour, that this guy didn't know squat about what was going on. And I just find it hard to believe that an oil drilling platform poised to tap into a field that BP estimates could have 2.5 billion barrels of oil barely paid attention to what was going on, or to the cost-cutting measures that were instituted, or the safety equipment that was bypassed, or all the other shortcuts that appear to have been taken. But you know what? What the heck? Public anger and outrage don't really seem to matter in this situation. They don't. They don't seem to have much of an effect on BP or the White House or anyone who's involved. On our website tonight, Webmaster Lex and I have put together a number of articles of interest, including two stories about BP and the Gulf. One is from the Washington Post. It's based on documents obtained from one of BP's partners in this drilling rig operation, and it's not pretty. The partner confirms much of what we've all suspected all along, how BP knew it was putting the Gulf at risk by cutting the corners that it most decidedly cut. Take a look at the article if you need to get your blood boiling. Also, there is an essay by a former guest of this program. He's a writer named Matt Stein, and he has an interesting proposal. He says we need the equivalent of a Dunkirk. Remember that? That is, we need regular citizens to come to the rescue and start helping out with the cleanup, if nothing else. And I sort of had the same thought myself a while back. I'll bet you could get 1 million volunteers in a month if someone at the top asked for them or could decide how to coordinate them if they had them, what they could do to help. Doesn't seem like anyone has any particular expertise in cleaning up the mess, does it, or solving the problem? I mean, thousands of ideas have poured in from the population to BP and the government, and they've been largely ignored. Why not ask the public to get involved and help save the Gulf? Go wipe off some birds or clean up some tar balls or prevent further erosion or destruction of the beaches. Take a look at Matt Stein's suggestion there, and let's hope someone picks up on it because, you know, the Gulf sure isn't going to clean itself anytime soon, and the oil keeps pouring and pouring out into the water. Also in the news, did you think that endangered whales were protected, that whale slaughter was a thing of the past? Whaling nations have always looked for ways to get around the international ban and the international limits, and soon they could see those limits lifted altogether, at least to some degree. There's a deal that's percolating that could regulate whaling for the next 10 years. It's up for debate at an International Whaling Commission meeting that opens up this week in Morocco. This proposal is being pushed by Iceland, Japan, and Norway, these three whaling nations. They want annual quotas with hunts that are more tightly scrutinized. That's what they say. Go ahead and scrutinize us. We'll keep the international ban on whale products, but we want to be able to hunt some of these things down and eat them. Some anti-whaling countries and conservation groups are supporting the idea, while others are implacably opposed. Few observers are prepared to predict whether this deal is going to be approved or not. The WWF, that's World Wildlife Federation's Wendy Elliott, put it this way. She says, "The global whaling moratorium is without a doubt one of the most impressive conservation achievements of our time, yet it's not working for everyone," meaning it's not working for the countries that still want to eat whales. A couple of months ago, the chairman of the Whaling Commission released a draft proposal based on discussions that are underway for over the past couple of years. There are indications, of course, that the two sides are far apart. Australia's commissioner to this Whaling Commission, Donna Petrichenko, argued that as things stand, the deal would undermine the commercial whaling operation or moratorium that's been in place since 1986. It has to remain in place, she said. What we see in this proposal would be sanctioning of commercial whaling in the Southern Ocean and a whale sanctuary and commercial whaling in the North Pacific and commercial whaling in the North Atlantic. Keep an eye on that one, folks. I'm guessing if you have conservationists on one side wanting to protect whales and big fishing conglomerates and nations on the other wanting to hunt and eat them, we can guess how that one is going to work out. Let's take our first break, come back and talk about some other news items, then go to the phones to hear what you have to say. And then, as I mentioned, in hour two, Bud Hopkins will be here with us. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. Coming up, open lines, your phone calls to talk about whatever. And then in hour two, author, painter, and UFO investigator Bud Hopkins will be here to talk about his amazing life and research. A couple of other items. Webmaster Lex and I have found that might be of some interest to you if the world's top scientists had a wish list and could come up with the most desirable, most beneficial scientific advances, I guess within reason. What would they hope to see? Well, the New Scientist magazine surveyed a number of top scientific thinkers and came up with an eclectic list of stuff. I'll give you a couple of examples, and you can look for the rest of them on the Coast to Coast site. Download human consciousness into a computer. And in fact, we posted a second article tonight on the website, which looks at the viability of creating something akin to an avatar through which, if you could download human consciousness, you could essentially live forever. Or at least the consciousness goes on forever. Also on the scientific wish list, travel to extrasolar planets, that is those outside our solar system, in a reasonable amount of time, and why not? And then my favorite, determine how to get by with no sleep at all. Think of how much more you could get accomplished if you didn't have to sleep at all. We here at Coast to Coast learn to get by on as little as possible, but every once in a while, even we need to grab a few winks. That would be a good one for somebody to work on. Also on the website, two thought-provoking items. You may not have seen these. One is about that team in Europe, which has now been placed in an isolation chamber for 500 or more days to see how people react to being cooped up in something akin to a spacecraft over a long period of time. I'd have to wonder about claustrophobia, wouldn't you? Being stuck in there, not to mention body odors, or just getting tired of being around the same people all that time. You'd want to throttle somebody after 500 days. And we have an article about Phobos. That's one of the moons of Mars. Why does it appear to be hollow? What does that say about the origins of Phobos? Which, if you've studied the UFO topics at all, you know that that body has been the source of a lot of interesting speculation in the past. And there's one other article that's there. It's about the Bigelow Ranch in Utah. There are some wild stories floating out around right now about what might be going on at this ranch, also known as Skinwalker Ranch. As a matter of full disclosure, I co-wrote a book about the ranch some years ago and the weird stuff that's happened there and has been investigated by a team of scientists. The book was called Hunt for the Skinwalker. There was an interview with the owner of the property, Bob Bigelow, on June 7th in, of all publications, the New York Times. And the article focused on the privatization or commercialization of space. And as many of you know, Bob Bigelow has emerged as a major figure in that effort. He's been my guest on this program a couple of times. He's got a couple of his own satellites that are floating around up there, a space program he's developed in a short period of time in about 10 years. Bigelow said something during this interview about his space program with the New York Times that probably would have floored any other reporter who was paying attention. They drifted into the topic of Bigelow's interest in UFOs, and Bigelow says, in effect, the UFO subject is very serious because of the dangers that UFO represents. And he adds that UFOs have hurt and even killed humans. Well, the Times reporter didn't say boo about this, didn't ask a follow-up question, just let it slide. I mean, nothing else. But when that remark made it into the world of UFO researchers and writers, things sort of hit the fan. The assumption was immediately made that Bigelow was talking about the Utah ranch, a place where dogs and cattle have been killed, vaporized, where there have been rumors of human mutilations that have surfaced in the past. So all of a sudden, everyone is abuzz about this story. Is Bigelow admitting to the New York Times that someone got skinned by aliens on his property? And the answer is, of course, no. His comment had nothing to do with the ranch. And I checked with the folks who work for him. No one has ever been killed on that ranch, certainly not by aliens. And if someone had been killed, it would have to be reported to the police. Withholding information about someone who gets murdered or skinned, that would be in itself a felony, and Bigelow isn't going to risk losing everything he has for that. So no, the rumor wasn't true the first time it surfaced. We even addressed it in the book that was written years ago, nor is it true this time. Not one tiny bit, not in the least. But I got a feeling it won't stop tongues from wagging about it. And in a way, I can understand why people jumped to this conclusion. Anyway, I included an article that was written about it. It cites two other folks who have been my guests on this program, Dr. Jack Sarfati and writer Gary Beckham. We're talking about it back and forth, and it certainly is an interesting premise, but it just doesn't happen to be true. But there is something I would say is interesting in this episode, and it might even be considered a breakthrough of sorts, and that is the New York Times reported a UFO story with a straight face. No wisecracks, no put down, no mandatory interview with a diehard debunker, just straight ahead stuff. And it would have been nice if the guy had been curious enough to ask, UFOs are killing people, please tell me more. But he didn't. Still, I think it's a major step forward to see the paper of record report this in a straightforward way. And if you wonder why I'd question the New York Times on this particular topic and how it's been covered or how it hasn't been covered, you should check out an excellent book. It's written, it's called The Missing Times by a guy named Terry Hansen. And he sort of details the UFO reportage history of the New York Times over the years and how they seem to have made deals with certain intelligence agencies to stifle the story or not take it very seriously. It's a really interesting book, and I got to get Terry on the program one of these days. Let's go to the phones. We'll take at least one call before the break and see what's on your minds out there. Wildcard line, Richard in Roslyn, New York. Hi, Richard.
George, how you doing? 500 days, you say?
Yeah.
How big an area are they in?
Yeah, no, I don't have it. The article is posted on the website if you want to take a look at it. But it's supposed to simulate what a space capsule traveling, say, to Mars would approximate. So it's not very big at all.
Oh, my God. I think they'd be at each other's throats. At any rate, I called for a different reason. But very quickly, I remember hearing the other program that either you, George, or Art did on Skinwalker Ranch.
Yes.
You know, with the hole in the sky and seeing things and stuff like that.
Yes.
Is there activity like that going on currently at that ranch?
I am told that is not the case. In fact, that was the reason we were allowed to write the book, that Colum and I were allowed to write the book, is because the activity sort of nosedived.
Right.
It's kind of reacted to the scientific team that was tracking whatever it was. Whatever it is, it didn't like it, the dynamic of that, so it went underground. There is activity in the Uinta Basin. I'm told by other people who live in the area that there's, you know, it's always been a site of some really weird stuff. But ranch itself, there are people, the Bigelow has employees on the property looking for it. And if there was ever enough a resumption of activity enough to justify a new scientific study, I'd love to see it happen. But right now it hasn't.
Yeah, me too. At any rate, I called because I think I just saw my first UFO.
Really?
Now, let me clarify this. I'm not a wacko, you know. I'm not a crazy person or anything like that. But, you know, it's 1 o'clock here where I live. I live on Long Island, about halfway out on the island. And I had to take, you know, I was putting the garbage out. And, you know, I looked up at the sky because it's been cloudy all day just to see whether, you know, it had cleared off or not. And I noticed there were these three stars in an arc, you know, and it looked like maybe that was the handle of the Big Dipper. So I moved to a clearing so I could get a better look at the sky to see where the pot was of the Dipper. You know what I'm saying? And always in the back of my mind, remember that movie, The Thing, with James Arnaz when we were kids?
Sure.
I'm in my 60s, yeah. So I must be about your age or whatever. But remember at the end, there was the reporter, Scotty, who gets on the radio and he says, "Watch the skies, all of you, watch the skies," you know?
Right.
So I was out there, and I'm looking up, and I'm trying to see where the pot went to the Big Dipper. And I start noticing the stars, and right where those three stars were, there's like a small light, stationary at first, and then it starts to move. But it's moving really fast. Now, let me tell you something. I couldn't see any UFO or any craft or anything like that. It was just a light. But it was like... when we were younger in the early 60s, you know, when they first shot up Sputnik and Explorer and these other ones, they flew in a fairly low Earth orbit. And if you looked up at the sky at night and it was clear, you could see them, you know, move across the sky. But today's satellites, they're in a much higher orbit. You can't see them with the naked eye. But this you could see. But I would say this thing, whatever it was, airplane, whatever, had to be at least at in excess of 50,000 feet, 50 to 70,000 feet at the closest, I would say. It was small, but you could see it. The weird thing was, George, it was moving very fast. I'm not talking like a classic UFO where it streaks across the sky, but this thing had to be traveling somewhere. I'm no astrophysicist or anything like that, or geometric wizard or anything, but from the arc, the way it was going and the height it was going, because, you know, when you see a plane very high up in the sky during the daytime, the vapor trail, the higher up it is, the slower it moves across the sky. This thing was...
Hey, Richard, that music means we need to go to a break. I'll just say this, is that, you know, there are some satellites you can see with a naked eye, especially at night, moving across the sky. You could see the International Space Station, for one thing. It's hard to say what you saw, because unless you have video that could be analyzed, not much I can say about it. I appreciate your call. We're going back to the phones in a couple of minutes, and then top of the hour, we'll be talking with Bud Hopkins. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast. Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight. Getting ready to talk to Bud Hopkins, who wrote Intruders and Missing Time, among other books about the UFO and alien abduction phenomena. But there's a lot more to Bud's life than just UFOs and aliens, and we'll be getting into that, the mix of art and science and writing and all those things at the top of this hour. In the meantime, we'll be going right back to the phones right after this, so stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Back to the phones, Ray in Gainesville, Florida, beautiful town. Hi, Ray, how you doing?
Good evening, George. I got a couple of comments about the oil spill. I know everybody's making comments, but I'm not very well good at writing letters and stuff, but I urge all of the listeners to write Congress, because I heard that one of the biggest problems is they're not allowed to dump the water back into the ocean after they've taken the oil out of it. And that's the problem that Kevin Costner is having with his system, the centrifugal separator. And he can collect 95% of the oil and just release 5% of the water. 5% of the oil and 95% water, where right now it's the other way around. Anyway, so also the skimmers from that have foreign flags, I understand that they wouldn't allow them in because they can't dump the water back into the ocean after they skim the oil off. And so if all of the listeners can write our Congress and give a variance, you know, there's exception to codes that they can write an emergency thing of the Congress getting together. My second comment is that a lot of the tankers that could pick up the oil and water mixture, the refineries have the capability of separating the water and oil, but the problem is the capacity of barges and tankers to deliver to the refineries and sit there and wait on it till they get unloaded, or sit out in the Gulf till they wait to get loaded. They're not set up a pay scale to do that. Well, why don't they do it like they do with taxis, and they just get BP can pay them to just sit there and wait on a load, you know, and these things, like, you can write BP about that and see if they can hire the tankers to just sit there, and really wouldn't have to have as many tankers coming from the Middle East. We can get enough oil right there, right in the Gulf.
Well, Ray, those are very sensible ideas. I appreciate the call. You know, a lot of folks just like you have called in, both to the government and to BP, with ideas like that. You've probably seen that viral video that's gone on with the guys with the hay that they throw on the water. And you know, I think we could try any number of things. I think the last estimate I heard where there were something like 15,000 suggestions that had come in from the public. And I just have the feeling they go into some big, deep, dark black hole somewhere, and no one really pays any attention. Kevin Costner, if he hadn't been a major celebrity and appeared before Congress and griped and moaned about the technology that he had available, probably wouldn't have got any attention at all. It took a lot of work on his part to get BP's attention. And if he hadn't been a celebrity, I doubt they would have given him 2 cents or the time of day. And so those are good ideas. It would be nice to see someone paying attention to them and putting them into motion. Thanks for the call, Ray. Ed in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. What's on your mind, Ed?
Morning, George.
Hi.
I've been reading a lot of message boards coast to coast, and a lot of people are talking about information that hasn't made the mainstream news about direct involvement with the Halliburton Corporation and the Gulf oil well explosion. And one of them says that it's interesting to note that Halliburton is named in the majority of some 24 lawsuits filed since the explosion by Gulf Coast businesses and civilians who claim that the company is to blame for the disaster. That Halliburton was forced to admit in a testimony to congressional hearings only last month that it carried out cementing operations 20 hours before the Gulf of Mexico oil rig went up in flames. The lawsuits claim that four Halliburton workers stationed on the rig improperly capped the well. And the New York Times also reported on May 26th that the BP officials chose, partly for financial reasons, to use the type of casing for the well that the company knew was the riskier of two options.
Well, I'll tell you, Ed, there's going to be all kinds of allegations made in lawsuits, and they will go after everyone. Anyone filing such a suit will go after anyone that they perceive to have deep pockets. I'm not letting Halliburton off the hook. We know what their history is around the world, and there's some good and some bad. I got a feeling that eventually there's going to be plenty of blame to go around, and it will all come out in the wash, but it's probably going to take years to figure out who screwed up, what degree of blame should be assigned to them. But I got a feeling that BP, Halliburton, the other companies associated with that rig, the federal inspectors who should have been doing their jobs but weren't, who were partying and accepting favors instead, politicians who were happy to accept big money contributions from these companies and look the other way. There's going to be a lot of blame to go around. I appreciate the call, Ed. Thank you very much. Josh in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Josh. There's no Josh. East of the Rockies, going back to Gainesville, Florida. Jim, are you there?
Yes. A while back, there was a guest on. It was about energy and said, that Einstein had made a refrigeration system work without electricity. That's called an absorption system. You familiar with those?
I'm not. Nope. It wasn't this program. Wasn't my program, but I'm listening.
Anyway, it runs like a flame, a little bigger than a candlelight. And it uses ammonia and another substance, and it has to be so exact. And they use them in refrigerators in, like, you know, campers and travel trailers. And I don't know if they still make them or not, but the instructor, I was in refrigeration school then, and we had a book that's like 3 inches thick, and there was 1/4 of 1 page on ammonia systems. Anyway, this was called an absorption system, and everything had to be just right, and they said if it goes bad, he said, take it outside, turn it over, and leave it inverted for 24 hours. Turn it back up right and put it back, light the flame. If it works, fine. If it don't, throw it away. But the only refrigeration system that works without electricity or no motors, nothing, just the flame.
Well, that's a pretty cool idea. I'm sorry that I don't know more about it, but thank you for letting us know about it, Jim. Appreciate it. West of the Rockies, Nick in Billings, Montana. Hi, Nick.
Well, hi, George. I wanted to mention real briefly an aspect of the tornado that hit where I live in Billings, Montana today.
Sure.
I was about 20 miles west of there. I just wanted to comment on the sky. It kind of looked like a dirty orange jello, just kind of where you could see through the black scud clouds. And I've just never seen anything quite like it. I didn't really know the tornado was happening until later, though. But I guess the tornado ripped the roof off the local arena and marched up Main Street and devastated quite a few businesses. And it's just a miracle that nobody was hurt or seriously injured. So should be thankful for that.
How often do you get those twisters in Montana?
Well, they happen, but it's so empty out here that, you know, it might just touch down the plains and maybe knock over a cow or something, but usually it doesn't come through the center of town. And this was a major part of the city, and it was just a miracle that nobody was hurt.
Well, Nick, go ahead.
I wanted to mention UFOs real quick.
Sure.
I'm 52 years old. I first saw one in 1968. I've seen them my whole life. And after I moved out west in the 80s, I would see them out in the desolate reaches of Wyoming and different places and watch them through binoculars and stuff, not just lights in the sky or anything. I've seen them land like the ringed donuts landing in cottonwood trees and so forth. The one I really want to talk about, though, was in Billings in 2002 or so. But anyway, I just never really heard anything quite like it, so I thought I'd share it with you and the audience. That one night I'd gone out on my porch and was just looking around and noticed some lights on my neighbor's house on the side of the house. It kind of looked like little Christmas lights, you know, the little lights glowing. And it was about a month after Christmas, and I thought, that's strange. I'd never seen them before. And just as I focused in on them, they all just kind of twinkled out. And the next, and I just thought, that's really strange. And the next day, there were no strings of lights on the house. And then I read in the paper that day that that afternoon before that, there had been a half sphere hanging in the sky over 36th Street West in Billings, seen by hundreds of people. And it was just hanging there in the sky. And then probably 8 or 9 hours later, I see these little things all over, you know, little clusters of lights dancing around on my neighbor's house. So it seems like, you know, that was kind of strange. And sometimes I wonder if I'm like the guy in Slaughterhouse 5, the main character, you know, the aliens keep coming back to him, you know.
Did you report it to anyone?
No, I've actually written up a little account of all the UFO sightings I've seen, and I can email that to you if you want.
Sure. Yeah, anytime. You know, Montana, big sky country, some of the most dramatic and important UFO cases of all time have been up in there, including the ones around missile bases and things of that sort, defense installations. Nick, thanks for the call. First-time caller, Jim in Lake Wales, Florida. Jim, where is Lake Wales at?
It's in the middle of the state.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's on your mind?
That oil thing there.
You're breaking up. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
The oil evaporates and goes up into the sky and comes down as rain. They don't realize that's going to happen. And because what happened, I was listening to the radio, and they was talking about an island that was coated with oil on it because the rain came over and it dropped all that oil on it. So that's a scary thing. If you have a hurricane and you got winds, you're going to have the oil catch on fire, and it's going to go up in the sky and catch the damn clouds on fire and then drop all the flames down.
Well, I don't know if the clouds can catch on fire, but if what you're describing is accurate, that it could certainly spread the oil over a much wider area. And I know that a lot of people have been worried about the approach of hurricane season. I mean, it's going to happen. It's going to happen sooner or later.
It's already been happening. And, oh yeah, if I was president, damn it, I'd have all the oil gone in a year.
And what would your solution be?
Well, there's still now that take and use it. I got a lot of them.
Hey Jim, I'm sorry. I'm gonna have to cut our call off because we're having trouble hearing you. You're breaking up. Your phone is not working too well. But we appreciate you calling in and call anytime. Wildcard line, Sheila in Tucson, Arizona. Hi Sheila.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Okay, I just wanted to mention that I see UFOs every night here, and I get them on video. I was wondering if you might know anybody who could maybe look at the videos, or if I could maybe give my YouTube address out and have people tell me if they see anything similar to what I see all the time.
My suggestion when people come to me with UFO videos is to take them to your MUFON, Mutual UFO Network affiliate. You have a very strong MUFON state organization there in Arizona, and I'm sure that they would have somebody who could analyze it. The problem is if it's just the light in the sky and total darkness, you have no reference points or anything, it's tough to make much of what it could be. But I'm sure MUFON folks would be interested in seeing it. So you see them all the time.
All right. Thank you. I do use the point of reference. I've been doing this for a while now. Can I mention my channel page for people to come check it out?
It's okay with me.
All right. It's youtube.com/SheilaAlien. And hello, everybody, if you know me on there. What's up?
Okay. All right, Sheila. Thanks for calling. We'll check out your videos. Jan in Brooklyn on the wildcard line. Good morning, Jan.
Howdy, George. What really freaks me out is when I think about hybrids. I was wondering, my girlfriend actually got impregnated twice and it showed up on the sonogram and everything. And I could actually feel an implant on her thigh. And she actually saw them come down. She saw somebody take out the baby. And she went to the hospital and the doctor said, no more baby. I was wondering, what's your opinion of hybrids? And also, do you know of any channelers or psychics, what they say about why they're doing hybrid stuff?
To answer the second part of that question first, no, I don't know about psychics and channelers, and I'm not sure how much, you listen to all voices on something as strange as this, and you take it with a grain of salt, so I'm not sure how much weight to give those opinions on something as esoteric as this, but I have heard about hybrids. In fact, the guy who's coming on in a couple of minutes, Bud Hopkins, has done some of the most important research in this area. I'm not sure how credible he finds the whole hybrid scenario, but I know that he has sort of is the guy responsible for suggesting that aliens or visitors or intruders or whatever you want to call them are interested in our reproductive systems, that they follow families from generation to generation, as strange and disturbing as that might sound. And I know that Bud has investigated a number of cases where women say they were pregnant and suddenly the fetus is gone. I'm not sure how many of those are well documented. The claims are easier to make than they are to prove. I do believe that he's got a couple of cases like that, though. And I'll tell you what, Jan, is that we will get into those as soon as we get Bud on the air. Thank you for your call. East of the Rockies, Anthony in Wisconsin. Hi, Anthony. How you doing?
Good, good.
What's on your mind?
I just called. Okay, it's kind of related to the oil, the big golf spill and whatnot. But I keep up with it on the public access channels and some of the things like Discovery and National Geographic. And as I'm watching, because they do updates each week, they have an hour-long show, and of course I listen to Coast to Coast. When they listed the people that were appointed by the U.S. government to study this problem, they listed a man who is the expert in charge of the deep drilling operations on Mars that they have currently going on. Now, we don't have any, as far as the public knows, drilling operations or anything going on Mars. So maybe it's an oversight for them, because they haven't mentioned that we have any of these projects going on or in the future. But at the same time, we turn around and we look, and one of the men that they've appointed that's in charge of this or that's studying the problem happens to be the man that is in charge of all the drilling projects that they have on Mars.
Yeah, I don't know about any drilling projects on Mars except for the little tiny samples that have been taken by the two rovers that are up there. I suspect that there are plans for drilling operations to go into the soil and look for ice and maybe even eventually microbes, things of that sort. But if you heard this guy's qualifications and he's supposedly in charge of the drilling operations on Mars, that would be quite a story. I'm going to have to check out the list. I remember seeing a news story this weekend about the makeup of that panel, and there seems to be a distinct lack of engineering experience among those who are on there. That's a very pro-environmental sort of a slant to the thing, which is not necessarily bad and is understandable in many ways, but you'd also like some guys on there, some guys or gals who know a bit about engineering as well. Thanks for the call. We're going to go to Vance on our wild card line. Vance is calling from Mississippi. Hi, Vance.
Hello. My name is Davida, but you can call me Vance if you want to.
Oh, well, that's what I've got on my list here. So
that, anyway,
hey, no problem. Okay.
I'm calling about the moon on Mars that's hollow.
Yes.
I'm one of the few privileged people on the planet that have been told why it's hollow and what's happened to it. The ETs on Mars have an agreement with our government, and Mars sends Mars bars to our government, and we in turn send them Milky Ways.
We send them Milky Ways?
Yeah, we send them Milky Ways after they send us Mars. That's it.
Okay.
That's what made the hollow part of the moon on Mars. It's been scooped out and made into Mars bars.
Okay. Well, that's a pleasant idea. Thank you for the call. Now we're going to try to find Vance in Mississippi. Vance, we're going to try to squeeze you in real quick. What's going on there?
I'll try to make it as quick as I can. I'm calling from Bay St. Louis, Mississippi.
Yes.
And I've worked around the oil business quite a bit during my life. Doing seismic lines, and that's oil and gas exploration, and all was getting into mud logging and mud engineering. So I'm a little familiar with what's going on out there, but what we've got out there, we have just punched a hole into a sandstone or perhaps limestone crust. And when when it blew, it cracked.
Vance, I apologize for taking the call and not having enough time for you to talk to us more. I really would like to hear from you about your knowledge of the oil situation, so I hope you can call us back, and we'll try to get you on for some more time. Stay with us, everyone. Coming up, Bud Hopkins, UFO investigator, alien abduction researcher, and world-renowned artist. Don't go away. More of Coast to Coast AM is coming.